the Genentech, Biogen, Amgen, Genzyme founders figured out that using recombinant technology and cell banking, you could make products obviating the need for human donors. The industry went in that direction and they never looked back. Today, there's more than 100 monoclonals approved. And the main advantages were you control the supply, you could scale it commercially, you didn't depend on donors that may or may not show up at the donation center when you needed them. You eliminated the risk of transferring HIV, Hep C, and some of the pathogens that caused nightmares in the 80s and 90s. And you had a product that always had the same quality attributes. Well, the exact same things apply here. The difference is the biospecimen, instead of being plasma, is now feces. But you too can obviate the donations here and make products from cell banks.
Hey, Philip here. Welcome to the fourth episode of the Flood Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you be inspired and grow. And today I was supposed to be in Boston, but I had to cancel my trip for sickness. So I'm in Berlin and I will do this episode online. I will interview Bernard Olle, who is the founder and the CEO of Vedanta. And Bernard grew up and studied in Spain before moving to MIT for his PhD and MBA. He then joined PureTech, where he co-founded Vedanta and then transitioned to the company as CEO. And today, Vedanta is really one of the leading microbiome companies worldwide. It has positive phase 2 data and recently raised over $100 million round in part to run the phase 3. I will not talk too much about his personal story in this episode because he did an episode with Luke Timmerman where they went quite in details, and I will link it below. But instead, we will talk about where does the microbiome industry stands right now, and how does it feel to run by the company in Boston as a European. So let's connect online and talk with Bernard. All right. So Bernard, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Phil, for inviting me.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. We finally get to talk live as well, and too bad we couldn't do it in Boston, but still going to do it online.
Next time.
Next time. So as I mentioned in the intro, I want to start really with the kind of the big idea and starting on the microbiome field, kind of as zoomed out as possible. I think, I mean, it was a super hot field for the last 10 years. Now you have at least two drugs approved on market. It's Rebiotics, Ferring, and Sirius. Vedanta, you're about to start your phase 3. I mean, it's coming really closer to like delivering patient values and like really delivering value. So can you expand a bit on like where are we now, like where are we standing now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think you made this reference to the field being very hot in past tense, and then, you know, reaching some maturity now. And I've been in the field for, I guess, 10 to 15 years now. And you can see two stories developing, what's happening in academia and what's happening in the industry. And those didn't go exactly parallel to each other. I think if you look at the academic output, the quality of the work that's come out, the quantity too, and just the collective knowledge that's been generated, it's a fairly straight line, you know. From 2008 until now, you've kept accumulating really good work in the field. And if anything, year after year, I think there's more evidence and better quality evidence of which are the things that the microbiome do that are in fact important to health and which ones are maybe less important. I think industry has been a different story because for good or for bad, fear and greed are more of a thing in industry than in academia, although the latter is not immune to that. And our field has gone through a cycle or a couple of cycles of hype, with, you know, some companies going public relatively early in their lifetimes, having some negative clinical reads, and then that affecting the field more broadly. and then rebounding with positive data and rinse and repeat. But we have gotten to an interesting point in the field, in industry, where there are now the first two drugs approved. There was an approval in December from our colleagues at Ferring Rebiotics of a fecal transplant based on an enema. There was an approval in April from Sirius Therapeutics of a fecal donor-derived drug based on the spore fraction given orally. Both of them are for C. difficile infection, which is the best studied indication in the field. And those are good news. It shows, you know, the FDA has put the bar here in terms of that's what's good enough and that's what's expected in terms of efficacy, safety, and CMC in this field. I think this also leaves a lot of room for improvement. I'm hoping we can come to a point in this field where we don't have to give feces to patients as the basis of a product. We can make drugs that are based on pharmaceutical grade compositions that are always the same, have always the same quality attributes, that are safer, where you don't expose the patients to the risk of transferring pathogens, and that are truly scalable commercially, where you can make drugs for not just thousands, but hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of doses, and do that in a way that is.
That's where Vedanta really differentiates. Where you claim you're the most advanced, for like GMP pure bacterial banks, or basically not fecal. There's no fecal donors or no fecal derived drug. At least you're your most advanced trial in the world. Which is a big deal. I mean,
that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to make drugs that are defined in nature. And what we mean by defined is that you bypass the need for a donor of fecal material as the source of the drug, and you instead make the drug from clonal cell banks by fermentation technology, giving you a product that is always the same. And so the ultimate drug that the patient gets is what we refer to as a defined bacterial consortia. By consortia, we mean that there's multiple different species of bacteria that make up the active ingredients of the drug, each of which is grown from clonal cell banks, so that each batch of product is exactly the same. By define, we also mean that, right? That it comes from cell banks and not from donations. And so the three key points that I made where I think we can advance the field, quality attributes, safety, scalability, stem from basically taking the donors out of the equation. If you make a drug that's based on a fecal donation, every donation is in essence a different drug. So no patient is ever getting the same drug twice, right?
And I remember you made that comparison was let's say the Genzyme in the early days, or any enzyme replacement therapy where it was made from donors and then they moved on to bioproduced and bioreactors, and then the drug was standardized and you could deliver it at scale, standardized, was always the same efficacy.
I think it's a useful
analogy.
I think it is a useful analogy. And this is where the biotech industry started. Actually, my thesis advisor at MIT, Danny Wang, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, he worked in the early days, in the 70s and the 80s, in developing fermentation technology and downstream processing unit operations so that you could make biologics starting from cell banks using recombinant engineering. Before that, the biotech industry relied on plasma donations and tissue donations, either from humans or from animals, to make the drugs, right? Yeah. Hemophiliacs, septic shock patients relied on plasma donations. And there was a time when there was no alternative.
That's crazy.
And today, it still exists as more of a niche thing. Like, for example, during COVID, you could see that plasma donations at the very beginning, when we didn't know what we were doing, was the only way to go. But when the industry figured out that, the Genentech, Biogen, Amgen, Genzyme founders figured out that using recombinant technology and cell banking, you could make products obviating the need for human donors, the industry went in that direction and they never looked back. Today, there's more than 100 monoclonals approved. And the main advantages were, you know, you control the supply, you could scale it commercially, you didn't depend on donors that may or may not show up at the donation center when you needed them. You eliminated the risk of transferring HIV, Hep C, and some of the pathogens that caused nightmares in the 80s and 90s. And you had a product that always had the same quality attributes. Well, the exact same things apply here. The difference is the biospecimen, instead of being plasma, is now feces. But you too can obviate the donations here and make products from cell banks. And of course, that requires, everything has its ups and downs, right? And that requires more technology to figure out how do you pick the right combinations of bacteria, and then how do you manufacture them reliably?
What does the downsides mean? I mean, a bit what you were, your first point as well. I mean, academia evolved rapidly, but also microbiome is such a recent field that a lot of the understanding, even the fundamental understanding is like, I mean, there's still a lot to discover. So I guess even for you to translate that into manufacturing, different strains population, whatever, I mean, it basically has never been done. So there's a lot of fundamental technology to understand, develop, that can be, I mean, this is definitely challenging.
But both technology and biology, you know, there are some problems that we have that can be addressed with technology. And then there's some areas of knowledge in the field that just need to be patched up with new biological insights that we just don't have yet.
You mentioned, I mean, the risk of transfection. I don't remember for which drug, but at least for fecal transplant, there was a big crisis. I remember a few years ago with some infections leading to patient deaths, actually. So I think, I mean, basically the pure fecal transplant is very, at least there is huge challenges from a contamination point of view. But I'm curious with, for example, Sirius or some other drugs, which are, to my understanding, fecal derived, but still quite standardized and lyophilized. And so can you go just a bit in details to from a composition, where does it differentiate? Or like where, because they are a bit standardized, but not too standardized. Can you explain a bit in details or like?
Yeah, I think the difference is, are you standardizing the process or are you standardizing the composition? And the products that have been approved have attempted to standardize the process of making a fecal donation into a drug. So how do you screen the donors? What pathogens do you look for to disqualify potential invalid donors? How do you process the fecal donation? Do you use an ethanol treatment like Sirius to separate the spores or you don't do that? And then how do you encapsulate it in the final delivery system, whether it's a capsule or an enema? How do you store it? And then how do you transfer to the sites that will give it? However, the composition will always be completely different from donation to donation with the donor-derived approaches. There is no way to control that. It is not standardized. In our case, the composition will always be exactly the same because you're starting from cell banks. So the 8 different bacterial species that are part of our C. difficile product are always going to be the exact same clones. And same for other products that we're developing. And so when instead of standardizing the procedure, you're standardizing the composition, then from a development and regulatory point of view, you care about different things, right? Since you now actually know what's in the product, in some ways, the bar is a little bit higher to try to understand and make sure that those specific 8 bacteria, in this case, don't carry in their genomes any features that could be problematic from a safety point of view. For example, antibiotic resistance genes or virulence genes. You don't have to really look at that if you're making a product based on a fecal donation. Why? Because since you don't know what's in the product, then what are you supposed to look for, right? But in our case, since we actually do, then there is also the burden of like, okay, now look and make sure that those genomes don't contain anything that could be problematic. And then also, you know, the way you you manufacture batches of those different products. Also, we'll likely get looked at from regulatory agencies differently, right? In one case, you're making products from donations, and you can contain, but you can never eliminate the risk of pathogens getting transferred. So what you see some agencies doing, like FDA, is making sure that the batch sizes are small, meaning one donation goes to only a handful of patients, but not hundreds, not thousands. Why? Because if there's a pathogen, you'll have some sense of containment, how many people are affected. Now, that's good from a safety point of view. From a commercial scalability, it's bad because you cannot get economies of scale. You cannot bring the cost of goods down by having larger batches. In our case, we can make batches that are enormous. You know, if you scale the fermentation, you can make a batch that makes thousands of treatments. But by the same token, since this batch can go into many people, you need to raise the bar on how well you understand what's in there. And so reasonably, the agencies will tell you, okay, give me a more full characterization of what you have in there. Make sure that you actually know what are the amounts of each of the different bacteria that you have in the drug. And so just two different ways to think about a similar problem.
But I guess, I mean, you've pretty much reached that now, not that you've completed the phase two with positive data. Can you go maybe a bit more in the or if you have some specific data to show? I mean, you're saying, okay, we have more standardization, we can produce more, we can have economy of scale. Can you maybe have some range, some like examples or how it compares? Or what are we talking about? I mean, are we talking about whatever, 10% reduction, 50%, 80% from cost of goods, for example? I mean, just to have a bit of an idea of how it compares. I mean, and I wrote down the date from the phase two data. I think you had basically was 50% chance recurrence without your treatment, or was, let's say, placebo, and with your treatment you were at 81% sustained without recurrence, so which was significant difference. But can you maybe just go a bit on the specific example and how it compares?
Yeah. So in patients that experience recurrences with Clostridioides difficile, which is a gram-positive pathogen that people often acquire in hospital settings, sometimes in the community, bigger problem for the elderly, especially 65 and older.
Yeah.
If you've had an episode of C. difficile infection and then you recur,
After taking antibiotics, in most, I think 80% of the case, it treats the problem or treats the strain, but then the infection, but then 20% will recur.
Correct. Yeah. So if you experience a first episode, you will typically get vancomycin, maybe fidaxomicin. And roughly 80% of the people will be fine, will recover naturally, and the other 20% will experience a recurrence. In that subset of the 20% that experience recurrences, you'll have people that experience multiple recurrences, whereby another cycle and another cycle of antibiotic doesn't really help, and they just keep recurring. If you take an average of the population of patients that recur, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 recurrences, what you find, at least in the randomized studies that we have run and the competitors that you mentioned have run, is that if your average population has had maybe about three episodes on average, then the placebo rates of natural recovery after an antibiotic treatment alone, which is the control arm that we use, are going to be somewhere between 40 to 50%. That means that roughly half of the people after an antibiotic treatment and some time will recover their microbiome and not experience a recurrence, and the other half will recur. And then the way our drugs are measured is how much better can you do than half, right? Can you take the other half and shrink it as much as possible? And so what we've seen is we can take this other half and shrink it to about 13%. So the difference between the natural cure on placebo and this 13% in our case is 30 points That's the absolute risk reduction. And this is the largest that's been seen in the field. For context, I believe that the two drugs from Merck, besiltoximab, fidaxomicin, but besiltoximab, which is the one approved for this indication, had about 10 to 12 points of absolute risk reduction. So we're looking at something that's 2 to 3 times larger. And the fecal derived approaches have seen absolute risk reductions in the range from 12 to 27%, but with significant variability across studies. So this is clinically meaningful because you're reducing the odds of a recurrence for a given patient by about 80%, right? So if you would have been in the placebo arm versus a treatment arm, in our case with high dose, then you have 80% better odds. Or in other words, another metric that physicians sometimes like to use is what's called the number needed to treat, meaning how many patients do you need to treat to prevent one of the outcomes of interest, in this case, prevent one recurrence. And our number needed to treat is three, roughly three, which means that for every three patients that are treated, we're preventing one recurrence. And that's a very good point to start as a launching path to run a phase 3 study to then validate if in a larger population we preserve the signal.
Yeah, that's very clear. It's great context on the comparing the different efficacy. So I guess you will be, you have potential to be basically best in class and I guess also first in class as a standardized bank-derived microbiome product.
Correct.
Yeah. And from a cost of good, I can you give a bit of a context there of like what does the cost of the map from Merck, what kind of cost we're talking about?
Yeah. So cost of goods information is very difficult to find because for understandable reasons, companies like to keep that information close to their chest. But you can do a little bit of back of envelope to understand orders of magnitude, right? Yeah. And in our field, if you look at some of the information that that stool banks have published, and I'm thinking specifically about Open Biome, which was a stool bank in town, and not a nonprofit, and what they were selling their fecal procedures for, those procedures were about $2,000 a treatment in a nonprofit setting. I think that's a reflection of how costly it is to identify donors that are validated and that can give you donating feces but are free of any of the pathogens that would disqualify them, any of the viral, bacterial, and parasitic pathogens that would disqualify you from being a validated donor. And if you cannot make your batches higher, which from a regulatory standpoint I think is going to be difficult, then you're going to be stuck in this range where each treatment is in the range of several thousands of dollars to just make.
Yeah.
If you're relying on fecal donations. It's a little bit counterintuitive because you're thinking, well, feces are cheap, right? You can just go to the restroom. But it's not...
Yeah, but the screening and the standardization of the process is super expensive.
Minus screening, you have to maintain donation sites at different cities so that people can go and find the places. You need the personnel to collect the donations on site and then basically process donation by donation. Hmm. In our case, we can really turn this upside down because by using fermentation technology, it's really about what scale you're producing at, right? Right now, we're making drugs for our studies at the 200-liter scale. At 200-liter scale, you have a certain cost of goods, but you can use the exact same process. I mean, in phase 2, we were doing 20-liter scale. You can then use the exact same process at 2,000 and 20,000 liter scale, and then you really drive the cost of goods curve down.
If you manage to scale at 20,000, at least there's some challenges ahead as well, but I guess so.
Yes, I'll comment on that because I think those challenges are. I'll comment on that in a second.
Yeah.
But just to make the point that by doing that, you can drive the cost of goods by orders of magnitude. And so that becomes very, very meaningful if you're in therapeutic areas where you have to make a lot of drug because you're going to be giving it for an extended period of time, or there are a lot of patients, so you need to be able to reach a broad population saying that tens, hundreds of thousands, or potentially millions of patients. Or certainly, if you want to make drug for any country other than the U.S., which has a willingness to pay for a drug that is fundamentally different than what the U.S. system is willing to pay for, right? So if you want... certainly, if you want low and middle income countries to benefit from microbiome approaches, it hardly can be based on fecal donation approaches. But you don't even have to go to LMICs. Even Europe, the markets in Europe, you have to
the
be
reimbursement
are at a place where the systems want to absorb them, right? And so the cost of goods are going to be very important. Now, to your point on scalability.
Maybe just before scalability, just to zoom out on the, I mean, cost of goods, just to kind of summarize and add a bit of context. But what you're saying is basically fecal-based drugs will be in the thousands of cost of goods. If you add to this 80-90% margin, we end up in like whatever high five digits cost per year, probably somewhere there, versus a drug you can be more in the hundreds of cost of goods and you end up in, let's say, a high, whatever, one digit, thousands. You can after margin, just from then a cost for patient or cost for insurance, cost for the system. Yeah,
I think to put it another way, I think if you're making a drug based on fecal donations, the cost of goods will play a very important role on what do you think is the pricing that that makes sense. And if you make a drug that's based on cell banks, you're more in the universe of small molecules and even some biologics, where you can look at what is the price level that you think is going to get good utilization. And in this case, in infectious disease, we have to think about things of like, okay, how many restrictions will payers put on the accessibility of the drug? Will you get step edits? Will you get prior authorizations? Will you get different healthcare systems outside of the U.S. to want to use this? And try to maximize the impact of the drug without being limited based on this consideration.
Let's move to scale-up challenges.
Yeah, so you had mentioned going to 1,000-liter scales and beyond. So when you're scaling fermentations, one of the biggest challenges historically is gas-liquid mass transfer. If the bacteria needs oxygen to be metabolically active, this oxygen needs to get in there through a gas-liquid mass transfer processes, and those are very difficult to scale. Because as you make bigger tanks, the bubbles of air are still the same size, so you don't get good surface area. And so you need to work with things like sparging, surfactants, and all different things to make sure that you're still getting good mass transfer. And sometimes you just can't scale beyond a certain point without being limited by oxygen transfer. Sometimes the cells are very finicky. Like, for example, mammalian cells, you cannot do any meaningful sparging because you're going to break the cell membrane, so that also limits you. Here we're working with anaerobic bacteria. The challenge is not so much can you get oxygen in
without
oxygen. The challenge is of a different nature, which is less scale dependent. It'll be, okay, well, can you run a process with the unit operations where in the right place you, in fact, are eliminating exposure to oxygen altogether? So if you go into one of our manufacturing facilities, you'll see, lots of people in glove boxes dealing with bacteria in anaerobic environments, right? That's a uniqueness of...
Especially the bacteria, gut microbiome, gut bacteria hypersensitive to oxygen. I always remember my dad is actually a microbiome researcher at INRA in Paris, but always telling me like that you get out the bacteria and within like milliseconds it's basically dead if they're in contact with oxygen. So I guess connecting this to your manufacturing process, you must have there must be some challenges to keep the oxygen really completely out.
When you have your bacteria in liquid phase where it's going to be metabolically active, you have to be very careful that you're not exposing it to oxygen. After you lyophilize it, is a bit of a different thing because then they're arrested. So we're looking at things like, okay, can you keep the unit operations really anaerobic, the ones that need to be, which are the different growth media and ingredients that those organisms need to proliferate when you cultivate them. Does it make more sense to grow them individually, or do you want to grow them in groups? Do you have the right cryoprotectant formulation so that when you bring them from a liquid phase to a solid form, to a solid powder, during this lyophilization process, you don't blow up their cell membrane or have it collapse instead? Can you use the right formulations to keep the bacteria viable?
So they're still active when you ingest them, that they're just active and repopulate them. So the patient,
so that if in this lyophilized matrix that they'll or powder that they'll be given to the patient inside of a capsule, when they reach the intestine, you know, you want them to be viable so that they can repopulate rather than dead. And then everything that I've told you, you have to multiply by the number of bacteria in your product, right? So for example, in our artificial product, we have 8 different bacteria. In our ABT product, we have 16 different bacteria. So you'll have X different cell banks, X different fermentation runs, and so on. In addition, some of these bacteria form spores. Those are difficult to clean. If you're making multiple products in your facility, you need to have a very good environmental monitoring and cleaning setup and facility design so that you compartmentalize and contain the bacteria and then are able to clean the materials that you use to make them.
Okay.
And so none of these things by themselves are a rocket science, but there's a lot of incremental things that have to be done to get the manufacturing right, which have taken us years to really polish. But when you get it to work, it's a beautiful thing because then you can really make a lot of product with good quality and at a cost that actually makes sense.
I guess you're a very solid CMC team then.
Yes, our CMC team is the largest part of the company.
That's amazing. I was always curious, but I think you answered, but on the lyophilization, on how, like, well, like, I mean, I guess it works very well. I was always curious about this, but I guess it's works fairly well. And
it can work very well, or it can work very poorly, depending on whether you pick the right cycle and the right cryoprotectants to maintain the bacteria viable. This is an area that where we do research and others do research too. If you pick an anaerobic bacteria and you just lyophilize them without putting much work into the formulation, the expectation is that most of it will be dead, like 90% will be dead.
Okay.
So that's the baseline that you start from. And then if you can get a good portion of the bacteria to stay viable by using the right sugars and other molecules around, then that's the goal of lyophilization research. And we spend some time doing that.
Yeah, that's great. All right, that's great. Maybe if we zoom less from the product but more to the like companies running micro. I mean, and also looking from a global perspective. I mean, Sirius and you guys, you're both in Boston, and then in Europe, you have quite a lot of companies as well, and actually a lot of research done here as well. But at least in the companies, they have not made it as far, at least not to the market yet. I wrote down a few preparing for the interview, because it's, you have Anterome in France, actually quite a lot in France, Anterome, Matt, Pharma, Eligo, in the UK, Microbiotica, in Denmark, Sniper Biome, IBT in Sweden. In the US, a few more. Like, what's your, just for the audience also to get the bigger picture, or if they want to research a few companies down the line, but what's your view there? Like, first, did I forget anyone? Or, in your view, how does it compare, or why didn't they make it, like, maybe on the market, or are they very close to the market? I think IBT has a phase 3 as well. So maybe if you can comment on that, on the of different side of that tantric.
There's a lot of ground here, because you've mentioned at least 4 or 5 different modalities, right? You've mentioned products based on live bacteria, either based on fecal donations or defined. You've mentioned companies that are pursuing biologics and small molecules from microbes.
Affecting the microbiome.
You mentioned Eligo, So then you're getting into the bacteriophages and editing. There's also companies doing genetically engineered bacteria like Synlogic, Novon. And I think you mentioned that the Danish company, there's also an element of engineering there. And that's a lot of ground to cover because each of these modalities have different pros and cons and different sort of strengths. And it's just the nature of, you know, how we use the word microbiome. It's in a way, it's almost like seeing genomics companies 15 years ago. Well, that could have touched just about every pharma that were using genomics technology somewhere in their pipeline, right? So, you know, I think all of these approaches have merit in different ways. And they're all, they all should be studied. There's going to be multiple modalities that end up being useful to patients. Fecal-derived approaches are already being useful to patients today as two products have been approved and they're being hopefully prescribed. We're hoping that the fine bacterial consortia could be next. But as people continue to study the role of bacteriophages and how to engineer functions into bacteria and better understand the pathways that are involved in microbiome host signaling, some of those other other approaches, including small molecules, will also find good indications that are successful. I think what you're seeing is, you know, this is a field that's mature and yet it's still relatively in the early days. It's like we're in like the beginning of our second decade, and there's still a lot of things that are unknown. There's been some first failures. For different reasons, you know, sometimes companies picked indications that might not have been the best testing ground for the hypothesis. They may have been differentiated from what competitors were doing, but not where you had the highest probability of clinical success. That could be a reason for failure of otherwise viable modalities that maybe if somebody tries them again, another indication will actually work. In other cases, you've seen failures because people skip steps and they went straight to a later study without understanding those response. And then it turned out that those matter. They had to go back to the drawing board, increase the dosing and get it to work. In other cases, companies did all the decisions right and they encounter very negative markets, especially in the US the last 2 years. And just died from the ultimate cause of death of biotech companies, which is running out of cash, right? Ultimately, that's what all the, if you think of a company as a patient, that's what the ultimate cause of death always is, right? But so I think, you know, in our field, you have a mix of circumstances right now. You've seen a cycle of hype with some investors being more bullish than others, depending on the timing. And then in the U.S. specifically, there's been several macroeconomic conditions conspiring together. We first had a crisis in biotech that's well into its second year, almost third year now. That's left the public markets in very poor shape and then trickled into the private markets, had high inflation. It's been a little bit less of an issue in Europe and Asia, but a big issue in the U.S. And so high interest rates, investors less likely to invest in biotech whenever there's high interest rates. That's normal. Yeah. So there's less investors. And then on top of that, you know, we've had some positive news, but also some negative news in the field with clinical rates. So you have to put all of this together in a bag, and some of the circumstances are controllable by the management teams of a company, and some of them are outside of their control. And we're all swimming in this sea of uncertainty, trying to find the best way for our modalities to be advanced.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, you put it really nicely, the bigger picture. And I like also your comment on like what's in control, what's outside of our control from a market point of view, from an investor point of view, from a technology. I mean, still science and some things will not work. And there's a kind of luck or out of control component, which I think is in biotech tends to be always a bit. I mean, it's very hard to measure, but it's very high. Which doesn't make it easier, but it's kind of part of the game. Maybe if you have a comment more to compare, like let's say or comment on the European microbiome industry or what? I mean, you have partnered also with European research groups, I think, in Barcelona and France as well. Can you just maybe if you have a comment there? I don't know, like if something you want to share from comparing the two, or because I mean, just from covering the field in biotech, I was always impressed because microbiome was really one of the like field/modality where Europe was actually like very not ahead but almost equal level with the US from academic, but even from a company building, from investor. I mean, Seventure was, I don't know if they led you on, but invested very early in Invedenta as well. Yep. So having a French investor going to Boston to invest, I mean, it was one of the field where it was always quite equal. So maybe, yeah, if you could just comment there.
Europe has the quality level of and quantity of microbiome research in Europe is extraordinary. And I agree with you. It's very much on par with the output in the US, not just Europe. You know, I think Japan too is another area where there's been traditionally very good expertise in microbiology, some expertise in microbial ecology. And, you know, we've had multiple collaborators in Europe. We've worked for a long time with a group, Ed Kuiper's group at the Leiden Medical Center, and with other collaborators in Catalonia, in France, and the UK and elsewhere. So, yeah, there's a lot of good research. The European Union was proactive in the early days of the field to put money into research, and that paid out, just like the NIH injected money into microbiome research about a decade ago. And so, yeah, when we've looked for ideas for good science, we're never focused on in Boston. The world is a very big place, and research happens everywhere. And in fact, you know, a lot of the technology inputs, intellectual property, early research that we've done, in fact, did not come from the U.S. In our cases, it came from Japan. It came from Europe. So, yeah, I think, you know, personally, I stay very open-minded about where the research can come from. In my previous life before Vedanta, I worked in venture creation, and that's a perfect ground to understand, you know, the world is much, much bigger than MIT, Harvard, and Stanford. There's a lot of good research groups that are doing great work, and you really want to cast a very wide net to understand where good ideas are coming from. You also mentioned the investment landscape with some European investors like Seventure, you know, building a name for themselves in this field. I think that's another important consideration. When you look for financing, it's natural for U.S. companies to look at U.S. investors, just like European companies will look at European investors too. But the world is a big place, and different geographies look for, or different investors look for different things. We've also had to cast a very wide net when we look at investors for Vedanta. We've looked at U.S. investors, but we've also brought in several investors from Europe, Skybus, Venture, and others, as well as Asia. We brought in investors from Korea, from Japan, from China. Some considerations.
No, that's amazing. And actually talking about cash, I mean, I mentioned in the intro that you closed the round with, I think, $106 or $107 million. I mean, congrats on this, especially in the current times. I mean, closing such a big round is, I can imagine, very challenging and very crucial, as you said, also to finance the phase three. I think that's still one of the advantage, definitely, to be in Boston/in the US, where at least some investor round, but also the public market outlook. I mean, when you look at the public markets in Europe, at least in the 10 last years, it's incomparable to the Nasdaq.
You know, I haven't gone through the experience of having to raise a financing. So I'm from Catalonia. I don't know what my life would have been if I had to raise this amount of money from Catalonia. Maybe it would have not been possible. or from elsewhere in Europe. But I think it's fair to make a point that fundraising in this environment is not easy, no matter where you are. It's not just like because you're in Boston, somehow it's going to be easier. There have been a lot of challenges by U.S. companies during this period of time too. It's just like, you know, it may be harder to raise money if you're a female CEO than if you're a male CEO, or if you're like a 50-year-old, sorry, a 20-year-old CEO than if you're an experienced 50-year-old CEO that's had several exits. But it's still difficult. Like, you talk to some of the experienced CEOs that have everything going for them. They have the marquee investors. They have the right age, the right gender, and it's still hard, right? So I think bottom line is fundraising is hard for everybody, and you have to appreciate that. But also understand that in some areas it's even harder. And I'll say, you know, we're very excited that we closed the financing, and you know, everything, you'll appreciate that everything looks beautiful when you put it in a press release. You know, as a private company, you can choose what information you should put out, and of course you say we've raised 106 million, and it's like, oh great,
I remember you didn't round up.
But my point is, like, the reality of running a startup is you're always fighting fires and it's always messy. But you don't have to put that in a press release. You don't have to say we're fighting a fire here, or on this day I'm feeling down because an investor was mean to me. The reality is, you know, it's hard for everybody in our financing. You know, we had to work harder for this financing than we worked for any of the previous financings, despite having better data than we've ever had before, which ultimately is the currency for financings. But ultimately, we got what we needed, which is the right amount of money to be able to run essentially two mid to late stage studies. One late study in phase three for our lead program in C. difficile, which if positive, we hope could be the basis for our first approval of a defined drug.
Yeah.
And a second study for our second candidate in inflammatory bowel disease, V202, which is just starting imminently, in patients that have ulcerative colitis. We think the data sets from those studies will be the basis or the currency on which we can raise the next financings. And hopefully we can get either one or both of those to work, hopefully.
Keep fingers crossed. As mentioned before, they needs a bit of luck as well, or let's say that somehow everything works out. I like your honesty in general, and everything you share, but just now the comments you made on like what's the reality of running a company, biotech or not. I mean, in tech, digital, or everything sometimes looks more rosy or people think, but it's really not. I mean, maybe a bit more experience there, and it's really not. And when you talk to people, and beyond the press release and the website and the press articles, it's a very different reality. But I like that you share that, and I think it's also. It's also important for our listeners as well to be aware of this, and sometimes also a bit more compassionate also for the people running the companies, because I mean it's easy to criticize, but I mean it's very hard to make these drugs and run these companies, and when you know the difficulty and the challenges, I think, and people are really doing their best, especially in biotech, people care and invest so much like energy and time and passion, and they're trying really their best, and yeah, it's there's some respect to be given there and to be shown there and understanding. So
it is a very difficult business, as our chief medical officer Jeff likes to say, not for the faint of heart.
But the upside is also amazing. I mean, when you talk about it, but like curing patients, I mean, with C. difficile, where they literally have no treatment option available. I mean, now you mentioned the two programs, but I mean, still like very little. I mean, it's critical unmet medical need. I mean, that's also amazing. Switching to what you said a bit. I mean, I wanted to get a bit your feeling. I mean, you're the first. It's a European interview who is based outside Europe to work or based in Boston at least. So I wanted to get a bit the feeling from you on like And obviously, you cannot really compare for yourself. I mean, you haven't run a company in Europe or in Boston, but just getting a feeling for how was it to, you know, to run a company to come here maybe without network and then growing your network and running the company, founding the company. Do you feel differences? What's your mindset there? Do you like try to just like be in a very like US mindset and get more rid of the European mindset? Can you like get a bit of a feeling of how it was in the early days, how it is still today? Like,
yeah. My impression is that in quote unquote normal times, i.e. not now in biotech, a lot of the steps that are necessary to start and grow a company are smoother in the US, especially here in the East Coast and the West Coast, than they are in many countries in Europe. In particular, finding the employees with a specialized knowledge of drug development quickly and with the right expertise and qualifications. Some of this advantage has been eroded during COVID and with Zoom becoming an accepted tool and remote work being more accepted, but they're still real to the extent that work in person is not going away anytime soon. Another topic. I think also the number and size of investment groups, the pool is deeper in the US, and for many reasons, they don't always travel into other geographies to get to know companies. And so if you're starting a company in Europe, you're working out of a smaller pool of investors, which in, again, quote unquote, normal times, they tend to be a lot more valuation sensitive. And I would say run their processes of diligence a little bit differently than US investors. Now, that being said, I guess the silver lining, if you want, for the European entrepreneur is that these advantages right now are completely eroded. Because
you're talking right now and in the past 3 years, I guess, since the beginning of COVID, yeah. I guess. Yeah,
because it's hard everywhere for everybody. So in many ways, this hardened training of starting a company in Europe without being anointed with a silver spoon by well-known investors and doing all the hard work every financing round, to have to hustle for every investor, to have to hustle for every employee hire, I would think has prepared European founders very well for those times. And it's good to see, you know, failure, to see hardship and to see difficulties early on in your career as an entrepreneur, because, you know, when you have to make very expensive decisions for a company as you get into later stages, the stakes go up in the risk of losing lots of money for lots of investors only goes up, right? So I think
that can you make you stronger.
Exactly. You know, I think if you're well prepared for this environment by the previous experiences that you've had as an entrepreneur, then, you know, good for you.
For you, maybe personally, from like, did you feel any difference from like, from coming from a European other background, and then, I mean, even when we were at PureTech or founding Vedanta, did you like have some like personal challenges there that are connected to your background?
No, I think that my integration to the US was very smooth. I was here for grad school. My grad school colleagues were incredibly welcoming. It was a diverse group, but the Americans were too. And I feel like the integration in the work environment in the US was also very smooth. I think partly this may be an artifact of Boston being a very international area already, but in general, my sense is that the US is a very welcoming place for entrepreneurs and for immigrants. Notwithstanding what you see every once in a while in the media and the cycles that the country goes through as Republicans and Democrats fight for control. None of that changes the fact that integrating as an immigrant in this country is easier, no doubt, than it would be for an American to try to integrate in Spain's workforce, both from a bureaucracy point of view, but also from a cultural point of view. Yeah. I think in the U.S., if you come with an attitude that you want to build and you want to create, and you want to make a career for yourself, that in many ways makes you an American ultimately. While
I like that.
Back at home, you know, I could imagine if you come from America and you try to integrate, you will always, to some extent, be the American and not the Spaniard, right? Just because, you know, historically there's been less exchange and less flow of people. But there's also some cultural values that I think are very conducive to entrepreneurship in the U.S. You know, there is an appreciation for people building out their own careers. There is a little bit more tolerance to both in the legal framework and as well as culturally to accepting complete blowouts and failures and then start again. And it's considered a good thing that, you know, you've learned something from your failure. It's not necessarily like
a bad thing. Yeah, I like that.
But, you know, that being said, Europe is not a thing. It's like a collection of many different cultures and many different countries. And even within Europe, you would find dramatic differences, right? Like you look at some of the cultural values in Germany, the UK, and you compare it to Spain. It's just like almost two different worlds anyway, right? So, you know, you have to make these comparisons with caution.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, I think it's. Back up. Or I have a very similar experience actually, coming and living, at least studying 1 year in Boston, and it's very, you can really feel this, and definitely can feel it less. Again, Europe is big, and depending a bit where in Europe, definitely some cities are more international than others. I mean, say especially like UK or even Berlin, but it's definitely different. Yeah.
And another thing that I meant to add is that the density of entrepreneurs and how that affects the probability that you become one is actually a big thing, right? I didn't have an entrepreneurial background in my family. I guess the closest thing is my grandmother started a business to sell furniture to tourists many, many decades ago. But, you know, growing up, I never met any entrepreneur or didn't really have any reference of a well-known entrepreneur in the country that was like a person that you look up to. You come here to Boston and, you know, you see entrepreneurs everywhere, and they will include your immediate circle of people that you know if you studied here. I'm sure, you know, among your colleagues at BU, you know several entrepreneurs that you could name and you know what they did, right? And being able to see people your age, your degree, that look like you, like talk like you, go on and start companies, in many ways, it demystifies it. It makes it look less intimidating than if you don't have a referent, because you can just, you know, kind of make the mental calculation of like, well, if this person can do it, maybe I can do it too, right? Yeah. And that is very valuable, and that's very much my story, right? I came in to do my PhD. My plan was that, you know, I was going to go back to Catalonia and work as a chemical engineer in the petrochemical industry in Tarragona. And that never happened, and partly that never happened because, one, I met my wife, which is an American, but two, many of my classmates at MIT were starting biotech companies out of their PhDs, and I was like, well, that sounds very exciting. Maybe I can do the same.
It's amazing. One thing that fascinated me, what you just said, is two things. One was the amount of PhDs I met in the Boston area, American or not American, who were entrepreneurial, was fascinating for me. I met many PhDs in, let's say, in Paris when I did some internship and research, and like I was not inspired at all. And when I met them in Boston, I was like, wow, that's crazy. And the second part is like I think when you visit, just it's even if you visit in biotech, it's hard to really grasp the magnitude. But if you've worked a bit there, the magnitude of talented people in and around Kendall Square, and it is just insane. And the likelihood that you meet someone very inspiring and that you will start collaboration or anything it just creates this like really, let's say, really ecosystem, and really
it really is extraordinary.
Create opportunities everywhere, and that's really infectious personally and inspiring, and gives a lot of energy. But it also contributes a lot, like to individuals and to companies.
It really is extraordinary. It's impacting when you foresee it for the first time, when you feel the delta of wherever you came from, and you start living here. And for me, even after 20 years, you know, you don't take it for granted, like the privilege of being able to work in an area where there's that density of really qualified, smart, ambitious people that want to do impactful, difficult things, just very difficult to find anywhere else.
Yeah, that's good. And I was about, for the PhD students who are listening to us, if you would recommend joining, let's say, like, venture creation lab, or more the industry entrepreneurial path. I mean, PureTech is one example, but Flagship is another one in Boston. But in Europe, you have quite a few now doing it, from Forbion, Kerma, even Sophie Nova has one in MedTech. But would you, and I know quite a few PhD students who have done that, actually. I mean, I guess you would definitely recommend it. Would you still recommend it today?
Honestly, I really don't want to recommend anything, because I've seen so many people now do very well by picking different paths that, like, what do I know? I've seen people do very well by starting their companies straight out of school. I've seen people create great careers by going to a large company, learning under a great boss, going deep into an area, and then becoming a great employee for a biotech, and then becoming founders themselves. I've seen people create amazing careers by starting venture creation, learning the ropes of what it takes to start a company, and then becoming more focused on being operators and growing companies, which is maybe an experience that you don't get in venture creation. And there's so many paths to fulfillment. You just need to be I was going to give advice now, so I'm going to stop short myself. But I think you want to be mindful. You want to be mindful that it's fine to experiment. You may not find the right job the first time around, or you may not find the right boss the first time around. But you know, biotech, at least here, is a very fluid market, so there's lots of opportunities to try different things. And know that in each of these positions, you're making some trade-offs, right? If you go to a large company, you'll have a lot of structures. You'll have very solid training. You'll learn from very seasoned people, but you'll have influence over a small sliver of what the company does, and limited visibility on the enterprise. If you go to a small company, you'll have complete visibility in the enterprise. You'll be in every discussion. You'll be in the room where it happens every time, but you will be making a lot of things from the seat of the pants and learning things as you go, with very limited training and support. And you know, as a result, your career may be accelerated, but it could also be slowed down depending on which group of people you work with, right? And same with the venture creation path. I love venture creation. I think it's great if you have the curiosity of playing with different things, understanding the first key steps of the process of starting a company. I love that, and I think it prepared me well to be more effective when I did that for the second and the third time. I never had the experience to work in a larger company and learn from a very seasoned mentor in areas A, B, C. You know, I have some colleagues that had this experience and have made great careers for themselves too, right? So
I like your answer. I like your answer that there's many, many different paths to even reach the same. I mean, there's many, many roads leading to the same road of like building a successful biotech company. I don't think there's really an ideal, like a very optimized. And I think that's, I mean, I saw it myself as well. And even for myself, I tended to like kind of overthink it, or even always trying to find the best path possible. But I like your advice of like, maybe let's say this light advice of like, there's many options can be very beneficial. And it's important to try out and see what works and adapting it to your personality or to the person's specialty, and then move on. And I like that.
And I think one thing I'd want to qualify is, I mean, you may hear what I've said and you may have kind of a nihilist tone of like, nothing really matters. That's not what I intended. I think it's more like, I mean, if you're going to start a company yourself, then it doesn't matter who your boss is because you're your boss. But if you will work for an existing biotech, for a pharma companies, it's not like they're all the same. There are better companies than others. And there certainly are much better bosses than others, right? So who do you
For oneself, with? Especially.
Exactly, yeah. So who do you choose with is super important. Yeah. It's not something that's indifferent. They make a huge difference. It may make a huge difference in your career that you pick the right company and that you pick the right group and boss to work with. So I think this is worth qualifying that, you know, when you're looking for your job opportunities, you know, referencing heavily the company and referencing the group that you're going to work with, just like they're referencing you in their interview processes, is a very important thing to do. Just like before you're doing your PhD, you should be asking other PhD students in the lab if they like working for that PI, right? Yeah. Although many people don't do that, and then they later regret it.
That's a good one. It's very good. I want to finish on one thing that I really wanted to also like, and I think it's a good conclusion, and I wanted to talk with you, and it's bouncing off on your TED talk, and which gives a bit of a bigger picture on like, okay, how to fight antibiotics or how to fight the microbial resistance. But I wanted to twist it a bit on like, and a bit like the TED talk is meant for a more general population. I'm going to go a bit into like, what are some like more, let's say, actionable things that people can do when you think about, okay, me, myself and my microbiome, what can I do? And I like the part in your TED talk of like, oh, my microbiome is like very, at least very precious, and it's my like immune system. So I will not take antibiotics and I will let my microbiome fight the infection by itself. And then over time, my microbiome will be more solid. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, and I remember your wife was going the opposite, like the opposite direction of taking lots of antibiotics up front, at least for the same infection. So maybe can you expand a bit on that, on like what you would like, or what you see today? I mean, and also, I mean, sorry, and there's many things in the microbiome today in terms of like microbiome testing, in terms of like nutrition to get into microbiome, and I think there's a lot of things that are maybe true, but really not that solid, or like still far-fetched. And I mean, I don't want you to give like medical advice necessarily, and be cautious there. But just for like the person, the typical our audience, who are someone who are like very biotech enthusiast or biotech or person working in the biotech industry, who kind of know what the microbiome is, but then when they need to take decision for themselves on what to do when it's like kind of health cross microbiome. What would you like recommend, or at least give some like way to think about it or way to apply it?
Yeah. The long story short is I would recommend very little. I underscore very little, other than some very obvious things around diet. Going back to the TED Talk and antibiotics, the TED Talks are very short, and usually nuance gets sacrificed at the altar of expediency to try to get a point across. And I think a nuance that is maybe not given the weight in that talk is there's a lot of antibiotic use that is absolutely necessary. Yeah. And if your doctor is recommending you to take antibiotics, most of the time they're going to be right. I mean, unless you have a viral infection, or unless they're giving you the wrong antibiotic because they didn't do the homework, most of the times it makes sense to do exactly as you're told. In my TED talk, I was describing a very specific, a very unique context, which is being hiking in the Himalayas, not being anywhere close to a hospital where you can actually diagnose what in fact is causing you the infection. So you don't even know if it's viral, antibiotic, bacterial or parasitic, and then having as options only those very broad spectrum antibiotics that that have a whole set of issues with them, right? I think this is a far cry from, say, being an oncology patient which has an infection in a hospital setting, which the ID doctor has diagnosed. They know exactly what antibiotic they have to use. You're at risk. That infection can get into the blood and cause death, and you should absolutely do what the doctor's saying. So, you know, just to make the point, antibiotics are a very important class of drugs that are not going anywhere. They're necessary. We need more of them. And, you know, I think the right way of thinking about microbiome therapies is as an adjunct to antibiotics, in most cases, not as a substitute, meaning that, you know, patients that have active infections, a doctor needs tools that can act very quickly in hours, and those tools will typically be antibiotics. There is a collateral effect of using those antibiotics. Unfortunately, they'll damage other microbial communities in the intestine. And for some patients, it'll be a good option to chase the antibiotic with microbiome interventions that hopefully undo some of the collateral damage of the antibiotic. I think this is a good setting for how microbiome therapies fit in infection control as they get approved. And here I'm talking about drugs that demonstrate their efficacy and safety with the right studies that get approved by agencies, et cetera. When you get into the world of nutrition, medical foods, beyond, this is a completely different world, right? Because there's just so much bullshit. Sorry to be blunt, but it's just impossible to know what for a consumer, what has good support and what doesn't have good support. The claims are not evaluated by agencies. When they are, it's usually in the context of, you know, using the stick against the company and being like, you know, retroactively, you need to not say that. But in most cases, you have these small companies that don't have sales that are big enough for FDA to even care, or the food part of the FDA to even care to evaluate some of the claims being made. And as a result, you live in this universe of gray where, you know, some of these products are claiming to improve your immune homeostasis or your regularity. And what does that even mean to a consumer, right? It kind of sounds good, but, you know, if you're a healthy person, what do you need to change if you're already healthy, right? So on the other hand, many of these products have been used in, many bacteria have been used in their products, in yogurt, in kefir, in cheese, and they're part of what's needed to make the product, right? So of course you need them to make the dairy product, but do they actually help your health in any meaningful way? It's very questionable, right? And so I think if you like to take products that have microorganisms in them, and I do, I take all of those and all the, by all means, go ahead and do it, but do not expect any meaningful change in your health. And certainly not if you're already a healthy person, you have nothing to improve, right?
Yeah. You haven't mentioned probiotics, but I guess that's along the lines. I mean, you haven't mentioned the word, but that includes what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. There. And then you also mentioned diagnostic tests. And this is an area that's been sore for our field because we've seen everything. We've seen outright fraud with U.S. agencies stepping in and seeing some really ugly stuff from companies, basically really trying to mislead both their investors and consumers with questionable reimbursement, questionable practices. And there's also some good research, right? So it's you have to be careful not to put everybody in the same bucket, because I've seen companies that are working on diagnostics that are doing actually credible good work, meaning using information of the bacteria that are in your fecal samples or in skin samples or in saliva to do something. And the something here is the critical part, right? I've had multiple relatives that did a microbiome test. They send me the test and they ask, they tell me, I've gone to the doctor. The doctor doesn't know what to do with it. Of course they don't. What do you think about it since you work in the microbiome field? And I'll look at it and I'll be like, well, this is a lot of bacterial names that sound familiar. And you're probably fine, as you already knew, because you're a healthy person. Why did you take the test in the first place? And they're like, oh,
it's just $200. Right?
So I think that where these, and I've taken some of those tests myself, by the way, I still do it. I think taking those tests and using it as a curiosity, just as you can go into Ancestry as a curiosity and say like, okay, who are my antecessors? And am I 30% Irish or what am I? That's fine. It is a curiosity, and that's where the field is at. I think where it really goes off is where some of those tests attempt to make claims that have any implication that you can make a decision about something that's health-related, or I'm sorry, disease-related, either diagnosing a disease or monitoring how you progress in a disease setting. Because the moment you put those tests in front of a doctor, the moment you put them in front of a gastroenterologist and an infectious disease doctor, they'll say, what is this? Like, what am I supposed to make with this information, right? Where's the evidence that having the signature of bacteria makes you more likely to have this disease or that you're progressing better on a treatment? And this evidence will emerge. There's no doubt about that. And there's companies working on that doing good work, but it is not today.
I have to be really cautious then. But I mean, some of these tests or claims are sold like, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands times, and it's like a couple of hundred $100 to make the test. I mean, it's from your answer, I mean, and I think it's kind of almost also my personal opinion, it's you have to be very cautious cautious, and it's very hard to even understand.
Yeah, like if you don't know, what do I do, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know a little bit about the field, what do I do? I've taken those tests. I think they're interesting. They're curious. I was curious to know. That's it. I'm not making any decision on my health based on those. I've been taking antibiotics as doctors have prescribed them almost all of the time, as you should. And
you made a very good point of this differentiated a sick setting, a therapeutics prescribed setting, and a healthy, I want to optimize my gut microbiome or health setting, which are two very different things.
The whole like, how do I optimize my microbiome? You know, if you're a healthy person, the answer is you don't. You're fine. Just like more than something else. If you're a C. difficile patient, then that is a very different discussion, right? Because there's a play for that. There's a place there for microbiome products. But you know, I think that the most uncontroversial piece of advice is, you know, have a very good diet, eat lots of fiber, eat lots of fresh foods that look green.
Five fruits and vegetables per day.
if you have many different sources of fiber and a large amount of fiber in your diet, that's the good thing. That's a primary food for your bacteria. It will contribute to having a more diverse a community of bacteria that's less likely to be populated by pathogens or by opportunistic pathogens. But let's be honest, we already knew that before the microbiome research, you know, pointed that, you know, nutritionists already knew that it's better to have, you know, a certain amount of fiber in your diet. I think what this research has done is help explain why and help illuminate how important it is to bacterial communities. Which is not to say that there isn't a lot of potential. I think there is a lot of potential for personalized diets. And I really like some of the work that some companies are doing in this field. It just hasn't come yet to the point where you're like, okay, I'm ready to use that for myself because I'm learning something from this tool that I didn't already know. Like if the tool is going to tell me to eat more fiber, I was like, okay, fine. I already knew that.
Yeah. That's a very good conclusion on the question. I think we are also running out of time and ready to wrap up. It was a great, great discussion. I mean, I loved how we covered from the whole microbiome space, zooming out to zooming in on Vedanta, on your experience as a European in Boston, and even at the end on actual insights for let's say healthy microbiome or for individuals in the microbiome. Maybe just to finish, I mean, where can people like learn more about you and follow you? What's the best way?
Best way, so I'm on LinkedIn. I'm a spotty user of Twitter. I'll be out for weeks at a time, then come back in and take a look. And if you wanna learn more about the company, then on our website we try to update all of our major news and developments. So that's another good place.
No, that's great. Great. Thanks, Bernard. Thanks a lot. Next time we do it offline then.
Very good.
Okay. Me again. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and thanks a lot for listening to the end. If you're keen, please hit the follow button somewhere maybe, or the like, review, share button, share it with some connections. It would help us a lot, especially this early in the show. And before telling you more what's behind the show, I want to say big kudos and thanks to the team. Kieran, web development, Catherine in marketing, Marianne logistics, Wayne in editing, they did an amazing job. And there's a lot of hard work put into the show. So now, what's behind? So FlotBio, the company, was founded in March 2022. I'm one of the founder, and previously I founded labiotech.eu. And we started the company building a marketplace for the biotech industry, but we didn't have enough product market fit. So we decided to pivot to a content business, with the first product being the podcast. We don't want to create, you know, yet another podcast. There's already a lot of them around. But we believe Europe needs a high quality, long form podcast to help both professionals and biotech enthusiasts be better informed, grow, and just be better at what they're doing. And so that's why we are creating that podcast. We are selecting the best Europeans in biotech we can find, and we are interviewing mostly actually offline, so we can have really the highest quality, both technical aspect, but most importantly on the dance and the content and the flow of the interview, the content. We release around one episode per month on all the major platforms. Money-wise, we are financed by our own private investments, and our business model is based on advertisement. So it's the sponsored messages, slots that you see in each episode. And we are sponsored by financial support from individuals and corporate. So anyway, I will not make it longer. I hope you share our vision. And if you're keen to hear more, or you want to reach out, or you want to share some feedback, please shoot us an email, hi@flot.bio. Again, thanks for listening, and see you in the next episode. Bye.